in a change to the advertised programme, I'm proposing a kind of special FAQ session in which the idea is to look at the kinds of questions you might get asked by a professional interrogator, for instance, as part of a news interview or during an election campaign. Now, some people here will know that the other day at our delegate meeting, the matter of the party speaker's test came up. For those of you who don't know, that last century, this speaker's test was a sort of Marxist economics test, a bit like the London cab driver's knowledge test. And it was for members wanting to do debates or, as I say, standing election campaigns. It was probably because at that time, the party did a lot of debates with left-wing groups who did like to ask those sort of questions. Anyway, more recently, the speaker's test was rewritten to cover rather more contemporary social issues that you might actually get asked. There's even a little preamble to the speaker's test that invites you to imagine you're being interviewed by Andrew Neil or Jeremy Paxman, slightly ominously. If that doesn't put people off, I don't know what will. But it's quite a good, interesting set of questions, though. I've put the actual document is in the Useful Links channel. If you want to, you can just go and click in the Useful Links text channel and just download the document, the modern speaker's test. So it's a bit like a multiple choice FAQ session. So, and it struck me that it might make a good subject, for a Wednesday night in itself. Both in terms of what's the best way to answer the questions and are they good questions? Are they questions that should be in there? Or are there other questions that ought to be in there but aren't? Some questions are pretty straightforward. You know, you can just, they're pretty obvious what you do. Others of them are quite hard, at least to answer concisely. So what I thought I'd do with your permission is to read out each question in turn and then see if somebody wants to have a go at answering it. You can sort of take turns or volunteer or something. And then we can decide if that's a good answer, we're happy with that, or if we can think of a way to improve it. Now, there are 36 questions in this version, so we probably won't get through them all tonight. But this is a bit of a last-minute experiment. But should we give it a try and see how it goes? How do you feel about that? Okay, so I'm going to start with the first question then, and it goes like this. And by the way, these aren't the only questions you could be asked. There are some other questions that my friends have been suggesting to me just the other day, which we could go on to as well. So here's the first question. More people are thriving today under capitalism than ever before and with higher standards of living. Is it really so bad? Does anybody want to have a go with that one?
Well, the language standard.
I don't think anyone's going to have a go, Paddy.
No, it doesn't sound like it, does it? Is that because it's hard, or
I'd be willing to take a punt at this.
Go on.
All right, I'll take a kick at this.
Go on, then.
I'll go and do it. So, let me just get it back. I mean, this is right, really, really off the cuff. But one of the first things that I would say was dealing with this question, and you can tell I'm thinking as I'm speaking, I'm just blabbing away and I'm trying to think about what I'm going to do. What this does seem this in certain respects this is correct, because we have seen that capitalism as that workers. In one sense, we've been able to improve the living conditions under capitalism. We cannot deny that the houses that we live in today, that the forms of transport, that the forms of our access to information is far better than it was, or to health services and things like that, is far better than it was in the time when Marx was right. Because if you remember, Marx talks about the increasing misery of the world. Now, on a material level, that's obviously not going. That's obviously there have been these obvious improvements that I've just mentioned. But what are we doing? Are we talking about what are we comparing it with? Are we comparing it with the situation of the 1850s when people were dying at 40 or younger, working class people were dying at 40 or younger? Or are we, so while it will be wrong for us to compare it with that, what we need to do is, or wrong to deny that there haven't been improvements made since that, then what we have to do is look at the potentiality of social production that exists today. And in that respect, then we could see that we've not achieved the types of standards that we could achieve.
Well, if I can just interject as Jeremy Paxman a minute, is it getting worse? Is capitalism getting worse, or is it getting better for people? Which is it?
The issue to me isn't always going to be what about can I afford four slices of bread this week when last week I could afford three slices of bread. The issue of working class life under capitalism is that we can at all times we're subject to the winds of change. At any time, capitalism can go really, really bad, and we'll have our living standards reduced. If we take a look at capitalism in my lifetime, for example, what's happened to various benefits that people had in the past, such as free university or grants for university education, pensions at 60 for women, pensions at 65 for men. Men in the last few years have lost 2 years of retired life. And women have lost 7 years of retired life. They've now got to carry on until the 67.
Can I interject again? I'm just thinking, how do we think it's going so far? I mean, this is one question. How do you feel that you're dealing with this so far? This is the reason for these questions. A bit of rubbish.
Why did you cut to the chase? And Jerome's tell Steve that his response is far too long-winded.
I wasn't going to be so cruel, Brian.
But it didn't need to be cruel.
This is the reason for this.
When we took the speaking test, that's what we were told. That's be quick.
Okay.
So you want the
sort of
please, Brian, put me right. I'm happy to put me right.
You want the sort of killer fact, don't you? Really, the sort of killer comeback here. That's the ideal, isn't it? I suppose. What's? Yeah. Hello, Nick. Yeah. You're a bit quiet, Nick.
Oh, no, it's my headset.
Oh, that's much better. Yeah, yeah.
Oh, it's bloody decided to go for my headset. Right?
Okay.
Perhaps it might be helpful if you gave a couple of model answers. I know that's a bit leading.
This is the blind leading the blind here, Nick, I'm afraid. I personally would go for the widening inequality. You know, the difference between the poor today and the super rich is stratospheric compared to how what it's ever been. That's continually got worse. So that would be my inclination to go for that. But does anybody have an even better comeback for that?
Let's just tell Nick that we don't have set answers.
No, that's the thing.
That's another thing. So I mean, it was a good assumption, but there aren't any. So Brian, let's have a concise answer, please, Brian Johnson.
As well, it's like I said right at the beginning. You know, it depends on how you draw the standard. What standard are you going by? In other words, check the question back into the phases. at their man try and answer the question.
So if I ask you the question, Brian, you're going to say to me what exactly? Is it getting better or is it getting worse? Is it getting better or worse, capitalism? Which is it? Now you respond to me and you say what?
I would turn around and say it's getting made better, it's getting made worse.
So it's neither. It's neither, right?
No. For some people it's getting better, but some people it's getting worse.
But then if you want support from the whole working class for a revolution, surely the fact that it's only getting worse for some people is going to tell against you, isn't it? Here I'm playing devil's advocate, bear in mind.
Isn't the answer that...
Well, you know, that some, the figure of some people is, varies very widely.
Okay.
From what we can tell, figures in regards to misery and poverty, right, that is a growing figure. I mean, at one time it was called just poverty, that the ruling classes of the world was going to solve.
Okay.
They're only looking at extreme poverty. So they what they've done, turned around and done is agreed. Poverty is here to stay. They can only grasp no extreme poverty and try and cure that. And that is that, by all factors of the imagination, right, is anybody who can live on $2 a day.
Well, that number's actually going down. That, in absolute terms, the number of people who are living on $2 a day is going down, not up. So poverty is getting absolute poverty. Levels are going down by...
Well, that's not exactly true, is it? That figure has actually been massaged a number of times by the World Bank. It keeps changing the figure that it wants to take in order to get the figure that is actually going down. You take decent, actually, figures of amounts of money that people can actually live on. The number of people living in poverty is actually going up, not going down at all.
Okay. We've got a difference of opinion, so there's obviously room to work. room to work on that one. Paula wanted to say something.
Because I'm finding it really difficult to get involved in this discussion. And can I just suggest that we use a speaking cue? Because otherwise some people just leap in. Other people, like myself, that try to speak somehow. I don't know whether it's my connection, but, I'm not able to have a voice. I just think, especially if it's, you're going to be firing questions at us.
Okay. That's fair. All right, well, I'll sort of unofficially chair then, shall I? We spent quite a while on one question, so should we move on to the next question, see how we get on with that one? So can everybody be quick? Everyone click in the speaking queue. Did you want to say something on this one?
I think my short answer to the first question would just be, well, capitalism has always been bad and always will be bad. And, we might have ups and downs every now and again. Some of us might get a bit better off and some get a bit worse off. But basically, for the class as a whole, it's a fucking awful place to be. And it's not going to improve. We need a different social system.
That's just the kind of answer we need, isn't it?
That's a good answer, actually. You see, you can't swear on Newsnight, you realise, but okay. Brilliant. That's really good. Okay, should we move on? Next one. Why not unite with some of the other socialist parties?
Just a minute, we've got Joel in the queue.
Oh, right, okay. Joel, go on.
Isn't the answer the interviewer wants like a yes or no answer?
Not always, no.
No. So it's not like when you're in court and the... the lawyer asking you will sort of want you to give a yes or no answer. I mean, when you're answering, sort of like in between the two.
Yeah, they're kind of, a lot of them are kind of what they call closed questions, like they're yes or no answers. But then you wouldn't expect to just say yes or no. You'd expect to sort of explain it a bit, wouldn't you?
Right.
Okay. All right. So next one. So we're all in the speaking queue, are we? Just going to use that. Okay. Why not unite with some of the other socialist parties? Surely more can be achieved in unison than in isolation. That's question two. Who wants to have a go at that?
Yeah, I could have to do that.
Can you use the speaking queue? Because there's quite a lot of us, and we're going to try and keep it tidy. So go on, Brian, you did say.
Depends on what you mean by socialists. Do any of these so-called socialist parties stand for production for use of common ownership of the means of production?
Well, I don't know. You tell me.
Well, they don't. None of the so-called socialist parties stand for democratic control of the means of living.
Well, they all say they stand for socialism.
What they say and what they actually mean, two different things.
Okay.
They are conservative, but do I stand for conservatism? No, of course
not. Okay. All right. Are we happy with that? Shall I move on? All right. I'll move on. Next one. Okay. Number three. Without doubt, previous attempts to construct socialism were disastrous, weren't they? Who wants to go at that? It's probably one of the easier ones, I suspect, this one. Anyone want to go? Go on, Howard. Yeah, Howard. Yeah.
Okay. Depends what you mean by, again, it depends what you mean by socialism. Lots of regimes have set up and still set up calling themselves socialists, but in fact what they stand for is a more repressive form of capitalism than we find in the West. And we wouldn't identify with that. It's nothing to do with what we mean by socialism. We mean a society of common ownership, free access, democratic control, and none of these countries have ever stood for that, regardless of the rhetoric which they use.
Oh, it's easy to see that you've done it before. Okay, Nick. Nick, you're in the queue.
Can you hear me now? Okay.
Yeah.
Howard seems to have stolen exactly what I was going to say.
Okay. Okay.
Just repeat it.
All right.
First of all, I would perhaps turn the question round to a question from the person asking you, which would be, for what perspective, what particular example are you referring to about a failed socialist great socialism? And then I emphasise that there hasn't been any true socialist revolution. Most attempts have ended up in a dictatorial state capitalist.
Okay. Well, I think we've covered this one, haven't we? I think you agreed Howard's given us a good answer to that one. So,
yeah. I mean, that's what I've written down. So.
Yeah. Okay. Steve, do you want to say something?
Yeah, just to come back to Howard, because you would say that, wouldn't you? Because you've seen what's happened. It's been a disaster. Communism's been a disaster, whereas it's been tried. And you're always saying that no, and you're like, You want to claim that you're the only true socialist. So what have you got to say to that?
Well, if we turn every single question into a conversation, we won't get very far, will we? I mean, you could always come back against anything.
I've seen this. I've seen this on the internet. And I've got the answer. I'll provide the answer.
Oh, okay.
Which is this say, oh, well, you're saying that you're the only former socialist around and stuff like that, and but these socialists, these are people that have proven to be politically relevant in the past. Well, the only answer that we've got is that, well, we were actually criticising this from 1919 onwards, 1919 onwards, and we've always criticised these minority revolutions. Since 1918, and we can point to the standard. And I think that's a really important thing, because honestly, when you look at some of these some of this stuff that goes on some of the criticism that you see on online, it's always that. Oh yeah, but you're just saying that now.
Well, yeah. Okay.
This is 1918, based on the materialist conception of history. Well, that's it.
Okay. All right, moving on then. Next one is, why are you so hostile to the state? Don't most people feel it's there to help and protect them? Now, who wants to take that one on? That's a tricky one, isn't it?
No, it's not.
Well, it's tricky to think how you can say it, how you can give a concise answer. A lot of these are quite hard to think of how you can give concise answers. Go on, Brian.
What you do, after you frame the question around is on appearances. Yes, the state is, looks like on appearances, especially first appearances, that the state is there to help everybody and anybody. But the actual fact of the matter is that the state is there only to represent the ruling class. I mean, examples of that helping dish out is Kim virtually every day, but especially today with his Chancellor's statement on the spending review. Once he do, he turns around and he's there. It's all directed at getting out of this poverty-stricken condition caused by the pandemic, right? And ensuring that the economic questions are foremost on the agenda. Right? And why are they foremost on the agenda? Because economics only benefits the working class. A bigger example of that on the ground was given to us in 1984, 1985 with the miners' strike. What occurred? You know, the state was there to ensure that the strike never succeeded.
Okay. I like the way you introduced a bit of topicality up to the minute. That's really good. But I think you undermined it a bit by referring to the 40 years ago, because then it made you sound like you were living in the past, but that's just a by the by. Anybody else on that before I move on? No? Okay. The next one. If democracy in capitalism is a sham, why does the Socialist Party stand in elections? Paula? Paula, did you want to say something?
Sorry, I forgot to unmute. Right. Can you hear me?
Yep.
Right, okay, so I was just going to say that's a really good question because it's one that I ask myself every time I'm a candidate for the election.
Okay, yeah.
And I suppose the trite answer is that it's to give ourselves publicity. But anyway, I don't know. I mean, would I ever be sitting on Newsnight and ask this question? No. Because I would never be putting myself forward as a candidate, and I don't think the Socialist Party should be until such time as we have proportional representation. I'm sorry, but until, as long as we've got first past the post as an electoral system, to me it's just utterly pointless.
Okay.
It's not a good means of publicising ourselves, because we get hoisting this very petard, why are you standing?
Okay.
And it's just really weak just to be saying, well, it's, you know, to get publicity.
Okay. Yeah, that's probably not the best answer, is it, the publicity argument? I think what it's getting at is if you don't believe in capitalist democracy, what are you doing standing in elections at all? Anyone else want to have another run at that? Howard?
I think there are good reasons, two good reasons of standing in elections. One is that at election time, what happens is that people are more politically attuned than they are most of the rest of the time, and therefore it gives us the opportunity, as any other party, to put our message across, and people are more likely to be receptive, whether they vote for us or not. And a second reason is that it's a signal. It's a signal that we are a democratic organisation. That even if we don't think capitalist democracy is sufficient, we do think democracy is necessary in order to bring about socialism. And therefore, we are prepared to put forward candidates to indicate this and to indicate that once we have a socialist majority, we will be in a position to actually vote socialism in, rather than bring it in by any other means. I think that's the kind of argument that we need to put. I think it's a good argument as well, to be honest.
Okay, Steve?
Yeah, well, the addition to that is that if we don't capture the state, it could be used against us. it's very unlikely that they would be able to use the first steadfasters, but it's just because the armed forces and the police forces, they come from the working class, so we can probably assume that when we've got a socialist majority amongst the working class, that there isn't going to be the potential to use the armed forces against us. But it's just an insurance policy. By capturing that part of the state which is Parliament, then we at least have a certain we would have more control over what happens with the forces of the state.
Okay. I think there's probably even other arguments you could put forward. I mean, what about the idea that we think that democracy and capitalism is a sham? Do we actually think it's a sham as such? I would have said that we didn't think democracy was a sham. It's just that it's not done very well in capitalism. But it's better than no democracy at all. It's like that old saying of Churchill's, isn't it? Democracy is the worst form of government apart from all the others. Okay, nothing more on that one. So, on to the next one then. So, the next one is, would a Socialist Party representative elected to Parliament take the Oath of Allegiance? That's, you have to, the Oath of Allegiance to the Queen that you have to take if you want to take your seat. Anybody want to take that? Oh, that's Brian. Brian? Brian Johnson?
Yeah, that's an easy one. Yes, we would take the vote of allegiance, knowing quite well it's just a ritual that we need to go through in order to take our seat.
Okay.
If we don't take the vote of allegiance, we're not able to stand in the Parliament and represent the working class. And by that, I mean, I'm not talking about representing our constituency, but representing the class. The class that comes, the class who actually turn around, form, and can abolish capitalism if we so wish.
Okay.
In order to carry that out, we need to take the vote of allegiance. It's a sham, it's a ritual, but there we are. That's how capitalism works.
So, as Jeremy Paxman, I would say, you just liars then. But moving on, Paula is next.
No.
Paula's saying no.
No, and that's all. I mean, I don't need to say any more than that.
You wouldn't. Okay, all right. Well, we don't always have to agree on everything, do we, in the party? Mike Foster.
I personally wouldn't take the vote of allegiance, and I think, as you pointed out, you know, there's the accusation of hypocrisy if we do. I remember someone saying, you know, take the oath of allegiance, but have your fingers crossed behind your back when you do. But I'm not sure if that quite compensates. So I agree with Paula there. That's a no from me.
Okay. Nick?
No, I don't think we should, because you're effectively supporting the capitalist state.
Okay, all right. That's interesting. That's spread of opinion here. John Cumming.
I saw a number of years ago an article in the Standard in which the statement was made that the Oath of Allegiance would not prevent socialist delegates from taking their seats, but then it offered no further explanation. And I always assumed that the explanation was that by the time we had a majority of socialists, no one could really demand of us that we utter the Oath of Allegiance. But if by some mischance there was some fuss over it, I would swear the Oath of Allegiance on the basis, first of all, that it's expedient to do so and it means nothing. And secondly, if there is any meaning attached to it, there's a part at the very end that says, after you swear allegiance to the Majestic One and our heirs and successors, that would be according to law. So according to law allows for the Parliament, of which you've now become a member. So I think you could argue, perhaps with a degree of dishonesty, but you could argue with the bourgeois supporters that you're not being inconsistent in any way, shape or form. But the main thing is to capture power. If we have a majority, we have a majority.
Okay, all right. I mean, I think Sinn Féin used to never take their seats, did they? Because they wouldn't swear the Oath of Allegiance. And they seem to get elected. They seem to get re-elected despite not taking their seat and presumably not being able to function as an MP. Richards, next.
Yeah, I just have a question on this. What actually are you swearing an oath of allegiance to? You're swearing an oath of allegiance to the Crown. But what does that actually mean? I mean, in terms of what does that commit you to? I don't actually know, so I wouldn't know the answer to this. I would swear an oath of allegiance, particularly, for example, at the beginning when movement started to develop. Say there are no socialist members in Parliament. What are you going to do? Are you just not going to take your seat and not going to take your seat? I think that's not a bad idea anyway, because I don't like the idea of having members of socialist people and members in representatives in Parliament who are going to be voting on issues that are not of questions of socialism. But there we go.
Yeah, I don't know what it means either. I presumed it was just empty ritual as well. Steve was in the Steve was in the list, but then he's disappeared again. Paula.
Well, if a Socialist Party member was elected and they were the only party member in the whole of Great Britain that was elected, I should certainly hope that they wouldn't swear allegiance to the Crown and take their seat. I mean, the whole point of the party is that it's got to be, you know, we can only get socialism through, you know, a majority of the working class agreeing to it and voting for it. And if only a tiny minority of the working class has voted, sufficient to elect only one MP, then that MP has actually got nothing to do other than to publicise the fact that they are not going to swear allegiance and they're going to stand down and they're not going to remain as an MP because the conditions for socialist revolution have not yet been met.
Okay, interesting argument. Howard?
This is an incredibly improbable question. Has anyone ever actually been asked this question? I just can't imagine it being asked that people would sort of, you know, work through all the implications of the party case and come up with this particular question.
Yeah, good question. It's in the list. We reserve the right, don't we, to say some of these questions are a bit pants. Steve, you'll go.
Sorry, I did the shoddy, the usual thing. I forgot to go to the news. This has been on Speaker's Test for years and years, hasn't it? Because I think it has occurred in the past in public meetings. So it's obviously come up in the past. Who's that typing? Was that you, Paddy?
It wasn't me, no.
All right. Simply that. It's been there for years. I think we need to do a little bit of research into the party article to check on that.
Okay, Richard.
Okay, that in discussions in the past about party tactics, I've been asked this question more than once, so it does come up.
Oh, okay. Mike Foster.
Yeah, just a small point. Yeah, I have sworn allegiance to the Queen. I have to confess, when I joined the Cub Scouts at the age of about nine. I don't know if it's legally binding. The Queen hasn't phoned me up and said, you know, I notice you're in the SPGB now. You know, have you retracted that? So again, I don't know. Maybe I'm swinging over to the view that it's sort of meaningless, you know. I think also Paula's right. You know, it would become more meaningless the closer we are to revolution, the closer we are to, our ideology being widespread. I think it's a question we should prepare for, though. I think it is something that might crop up at some point. So yeah, I don't think we should ignore the issue.
Okay, Paula?
Well, it's funny Mike should say that about the Scouts, because when I was a kid, I wasn't allowed to join the Brownies because my dad said, there's no way you're going to swear allegiance to the Queen. And maybe that's why I feel so strongly about the Queen now, because it's really sort of gone deep into my psyche.
This is a question that I thought there was a general, you know, party position on, but blatantly there isn't, is there? Steve?
Yeah, in actual fact, it doesn't arise, because if you look at the UK Parliament website, you don't need to swear an oath of allegiance. You can make a solemn affirmation. So you don't need to swear the oath, but you can make take a solemn affirmation.
I solemnly believe that the royal family are a bunch of shits. Will that do?
Wait a minute. But this involves, wait a minute, yeah, but there is a difference. The difference being that if you take, I'm just trying to scan through the web page at the minute. You're supposed to hold a Bible, I think, according to this.
It gets better and better, doesn't it?
Yeah, MPs take the oath by holding the sacred text in their uplifted hand and saying the words of the oath. I swear by Almighty God that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance. However, oh fuck no, this is just as bad as the other one. The solemn affirmation is without using a reference to God. It is I, Steve Finch, do solemnly, sincerely, and truly declare and affirm that I will be faithful and bear true allegiance to Her Majesty Queen Elizabeth, her heirs and successors according to law.
Okay, there we go.
That's what our Member of Parliament would be required, asked to do.
Okay.
Otherwise you can't sit.
Okay, John Cumming. Next. No, Brian, no, use the speaking cue, to be fair. John Cumming.
Something just occurred to me there during the discussion, which was that surely Charles I's MPs must have sworn an oath of allegiance to him. It wasn't a problem when the King became public enemy number one. They were able to quite swiftly dispatch him once they realised that this guy was never going to... come to some sort of terms with Parliament. So I think from that point of view, that's just an interesting point. But taking on board what Paula has said, I think we would have to be guided by what the general membership or the workers who had voted for us thought at the time. I would say speed the day when we have that as a serious problem.
Yeah, true, yeah. Okay, Nick?
Funnily enough, I don't think this is a trivial... It's a trivial question, actually. And I'd even go as far to say that you would be, you'd be breaking your own principles, really, by swearing allegiance to a monarch. And I think that would send a very poor message to the electorate, or the country, as it were. It's somewhat untruthful. So I would say definitely, emphatically, no.
Okay, yeah, I can see that argument as well. Brian?
Yeah, just to point out that swearing the vote of allegiance or affirming applies in the courts if you're a witness, and it also applies to members of the armed services.
Well, we weren't proposing to join the army, were we? Or, Howard?
Can we pass on to the next one?
Is that okay? I've got some people in the queue here.
All right.
Yeah, I realise you've only got really on question 6 out of 36. Richard, did you want to say something? Yeah, because we can't... No, Richard? No? I'm guessing not. Mike as well.
I was just going to say, carry on, it's all right, don't worry. I think we need to move on.
Yeah, we've been making heavy weather of this, aren't we? Well, then...
I would say I would boycott you and I would not swear it.
would be against the principle.
Okay.
If it was the first time SP member MP, I would say we would ask them not boycott.
Okay.
Until we get to the stage where we would have to be able to take power, then we could do a mass allegiance. Otherwise, we would need to
make our Okay, well, this is a theoretical question that we're obviously not agreed on. So the way we do this in the party is somebody will bring this up at a future conference as a question and discuss it and, you know, see if we can get some agreement on it. So moving on, as everybody wants to, the next one is a related question, which is why bother standing in local elections? What do you hope to achieve? Apart from sorting out the bin problem, I presume. Who wants to take that one on? It's suddenly gone really quiet when it comes to...
Oh, but Brian does. Brian's puts
in. I thought Brian had already spoken. Sorry, Brian. Yes?
I'm responding to this question.
Yeah.
In order to take over the reins of power, the socialist majority must not only control the political power at the central government, but it also got to control the power at the level of local government. Federal government issues the orders for local government to carry out. Right? And in order to carry out them orders, right, you've got to be a socialist majority. You know, if you've got a socialist majority in central government, we also need a socialist majority in local government. So we get things set in order to... satisfy human needs.
Okay. Paula again?
Was the question why you're responding in local elections?
No, it's just why bother standing in local elections?
Okay, so we shouldn't bother.
Okay. These are... Okay, that's fair enough. I mean, you can give your own opinion on these things. I mean, the idea of the speaker's test is, well, we give the sort of party view, if there is one, but we've discovered that there isn't a party agreement on these. Nick?
Yes, I think we should support local government, simply because I think we should push for a non-hierarchical organisation, the political organisation, to challenge the state and its centralised control and move democracy away from the state and move it out into small local groups.
Right, yeah. Dougie, do you want to say something?
Yeah, what happened with other parties, you know, years ago in the 1930s or whatever, there was a major recession and things, but some of the Labour councils in London inherited maybe £1 billion from a Conservative council, and they used it to alleviate the poor or whatever. I know that's reformism, but there are things you can do in local government, and if we were in a position to have socialism, it would be good to have people in local government that had socialist ideas as well, really. You know, I know people think it's just about the bins or it's just about things like that. But I mean, it would be good to have socialists in local government as well as in parliament or whatever. Just local government could be used for more democracy, really.
Okay, then. Howard.
Paddy, what you were hoping would happen isn't happening. I'm short, sharp answers to Andrew Neil.
Sometimes it's happening. Yeah, you know. But I think that kind of illustrates that why we've got a speaker's test is to work on short, sharp answers. I think the exercise is working just because it's showing, like, actually, these aren't that easy to answer in a really short, sharp way. You know, I mean, that's why, you know, that's why, you know, we need to work on these a bit, I think. But also, I think people have genuine disagreements about that, which is also interesting. You know, why we don't all think the same. Steve?
Yeah, I'll just try and be as quick as I can. Well, one thing is,
standing in local election would give us another opportunity, as I would say before, of putting forward our ideas when there is a certain, I mean, not saying a huge amount, but a certain amount of interest in the population as to political ideas. And as well as, and also exactly, I mean, I liked Nick's contribution. It's, to make people understand that they have got some sort of power over within the local community. That certainly would be something which we'd develop in the social society. Right, not very quick, but legal, that's it.
Okay, my quick contribution would be it's cheap and there's no deposit. Mike Foster.
Just a suggestion, really. We're never going to get through all of the questions on the list. You know, if we were, we'd be up here. You know, we'd be up into the small hours. So I was just going to suggest, you know, whatever point you reach, then you know, reschedule part two and maybe a part three even another time, rather than try and cram all of them in to this evening, which isn't going to happen.
Well, all I can say is, Mike, great minds think alike, because that's exactly the same thing that Steve said before, when I asked him.
Oh, right. Sorry, I didn't realise.
Oh, no. Before we started the meeting, because I had a suspicion we might not get through it. But, Steve?
Well, let's make it clear what I thought before, which is that some of these questions would be really useful if people just take a look at them. And maybe go back and look. For example, there's one coming up, Why Capitalism Will Not Collapse. Well, there's a brilliant pamphlet on that. You know, I think we could look at this, we could possibly prepare for this for a further meeting. But you, not just sitting there thinking about it, having a look at what's been said in the past in the propaganda.
Yeah. That's right. I mean, I wanted to do this on the fly, see how it ran. But yeah, I think that's a possible future session, definitely. John Cumming.
Sorry, that's something wrong with the pointing device here. Just a thought occurred to me that since we don't know how future history is going to develop, it could well be that certain localities will be more prone to vote socialist than others. So it could be that local government might give us our first opportunities to get some hold of some power and to use that to further the case for socialism. It's just a thought that occurred to me in the course of the discussions. But also the idea that local democracy is important. Proper democracy would be not a hierarchical thing. That's the sham nature of the so-called democracy that we have. Just now, it's enough democracy to get us power, but what we need behind that is obviously, as we know, conscious working class.
I'm just envisaging the SPGB en masse storming little Chiblings local council, a bit like Militant took over Liverpool. Well, going on to the next question, which does kind of lead on from that. Lead on from what actually Dougie was talking about. In practice, what reforms would the Socialist Party be prepared to support? Who wants to kick off on that one? I would venture anything that's good for workers. Paula?
For me, electoral reform is really important because if as a party we believe that the way to socialism is by, through the democratic process, then it's really important that every vote should count. So, I think electoral reform is important for that reason.
Okay. Well, we did have a referendum on that, so I think people would say probably that ship has sailed. But, Brian Johnson.
Paula just said it all for me. Thank you.
Electoral reform, right, okay, so proportional representation, okay. Any other reforms? It's worth taking the opportunity to explain our position on reforms, that we're against reformism, but not necessarily reforms. Howard?
Well, it was me next, but you should have, but you've said what I was going to.
Oh, I've got Howard first, then you.
I have to, sorry, I've got to intervene here. Surely people aren't saying that we could actually support reforms, proportional representation and so on as a reform. If it happens, it happens. And it might make conditions a little bit better for us. But there are many countries in which it exists already. For example, Italy. And I don't see loads of socialists in Italy. We obviously shouldn't support electoral reform. If capitalism brings it about, so be it. It might make our task a bit easier. But there are all sorts of things that might make our task a bit easier. That doesn't mean to say we should support them, because if we should support them, you know, we finish up like all reformists, sort of spending our time supporting reforms. So the answer is we don't support individual reforms. We're not against reformism. We're not against reforms that may benefit the working class and that may make our task easier. But it's not part of our task. It's not part of our job to support them.
Okay. Well, if you're an MP and the proposal is to give workers an extra bank holiday, I can't really see a socialist MP voting against that, or even abstaining. That would seem a bit bizarre to me.
We're not talking about socialist MPs. We're talking about the situation now.
Well, it says what reforms would we be prepared to support? So,
that's now, isn't it?
Sorry. Oh, so I read it as MPs, but no, you may be right. Yeah. Okay, Steve.
I got confused. Yeah, I think what I was saying was absolutely right. We're not going to support any reformist movement. We're not going to support any efforts to introduce this. But if we were to look back in history, we could say, well, certain reforms have had benefit for the working class. So it's an extremely, it's an extremely subtle argument that would be really difficult to put on the newsletter in that few seconds.
Okay, like a lot of these, I suspect. John Cumming.
Yes, I think that the idea that proportional representation is something that we should support is not necessarily a good one, because it's something that may well benefit us while we're still a small minority and give us some sort of representation. But once we become larger, we would become unstoppable, regardless of any kind of system that might be in place as far as voting is concerned. So I don't think proportional representation would be one of the reforms I would be looking at. I'd be looking at things that were just of obvious and immediate benefit to the workers that we could support. But you would have to be very careful that included in some of these proposed acts of Parliament that there wasn't other stuff to benefit capitalists inextricably linked with that. That would become a problem for socialist delegates. But again, that's a question that I'd love to be able to deal with for real.
Okay, Paula. Paula.
I keep doing this, sorry. I suppose it's always been a bit of a mystery to me, and perhaps, members can explain it to me. It's why in 1904, when we were established, I can understand why we were saying, well, it's got to be a democratic process. But at that time, women didn't have the vote, and most men didn't have the vote either. So how on earth did we think that socialism could be established through democratic means? And so I just sort of take that argument a bit further forward. And I look at now when, for most people, their vote doesn't actually count because of the first-past-the-post system. And I think as a party that takes such, places such importance on democracy, when we live in a country that is not democratic in its, parliament, in its electoral system, why we would not be in favour of giving every single person an equal vote? Over and out.
Okay, thanks for that. Just one thing that occurs to me about that is what you said about the Oath of Allegiance. By the time it really mattered, by the time there was enough of MPs for it to be an issue, it would be beyond, it would have got beyond that. I suspect the same argument applies to this, doesn't it? You know, if you've got enough votes, it doesn't really matter what the system of voting is. You're going to win it either way. But just something else. Not everybody here is a party member. If anybody wants to put a question, that we don't have to read off a script. If somebody wants to actually put a question to us of this sort, you know, something challenging the SPGB's view, you know, please go right ahead. You know, that's absolutely fine. In the absence of that, I shall just move on to the next question, shall I? Which is, hang on, we got Nick.
Sorry, I had to sneak in there.
Yeah.
Doesn't this come down to a discussion we had a couple of weeks ago that we were talking about the lesser of two evils argument came up when there was a hypothetical situation where someone had to choose between voting for Biden and Donald Trump? Yes. I think, yeah, it's the problem with voting for supporting reforms tends to dilute the message, surely. I mean, it'll end up a kind of dissolution of the left. You could end up with having to be forced into endless compromises and humiliations in the future if you had to, agree to reforms. You're opening to manipulation by the main parties in power, I think, by supporting any reformist legislation. That would be something that would concern me.
Steve?
Yeah, I mean, it's a shame we've not got the recorded version of Keith Graham's brilliant talk the other month about why the SPGB should not support reformers, because for exactly what Nick was saying, that we would end up attracting support from people that weren't interested in revolution, that were interested in these reforms that we're putting forward. And being a democratic party ourselves, that would entirely dilute and just change the nature of the socialist party. We would no longer be a revolutionary organisation. But I'm going to try and get a recording of Pomeroy Graham's talk. It's absolutely brilliant. It's far better than I can put it.
Okay.
I'm agreeing with Nick again.
We're sort of drifting a bit because we're going on to the case against reformism. But the question was, what actual reforms would the Socialist Party be prepared to support? And it's always been the party's position that we would support any reform that increased democratic powers of workers. At least that's my understanding. Anyway, but moving on, we've got Dougie.
Well, I was going to come back. I think if there's a sizable number of socialists, you know, voting for socialism or whatever, or vote for socialist members of parliament, the capitalist state will be giving us loads of reforms to try and buy us off for a year. So I think that would be the case. The more socialists you've got, they'll try and buy us off with reforms. And I think that would be a good position for socialists to be in, really.
Okay, yeah, bring it on. Freddie?
Yeah, thanks. Actually, Dougie Pound just made a very point on the goal to make there. So we ourselves are not talking about proposing reforms. What the question is, what reforms would we support? And you, Paddy, you mentioned one to state earlier on today. I think they mentioned earlier this week that we're going to have another bank holiday next year. Because Majesty's been sitting on the throne for 17 years or whatever. So there clearly are some reforms that we as socialists or socialist delegates would support. without necessarily proposing the reform. There are, you know, if they come along with something that says, you know, there's an extra few days' holiday, unions were fighting for some extra days' holiday and managed to get it. I can't honestly see us saying, no, I'm sorry, we don't want that. We're not proposing the reform. We're considering each reform on its own merit, and does it benefit the working class? That's the top and bottom of it for me. Thank you.
Yeah, okay. I go along with that, Freddie, actually. Richard?
I think this is a really difficult one for me. I'm not entirely sure what I believe on this. I think, you know, as Reggie said, you know, I mean, it would be very difficult not to vote for such a reform, but on the other hand, you know, it does dilute the position. Should we not be saying, okay, we don't want the crumbs, we want the whole bakery. You know, we actually want the whole, you know, should that not be our response in Parliament when we actually have enough MPs there? On the other hand, there is another situation which occurs to me, which would be very, very difficult to avoid. And that is that if a parliament or a government were proposed a reform which severely damaged the interests of the working class, what would we do about that? I think that would be a very, very difficult one for us to deal with. I think we would probably have to vote against it, whatever sort of principled position we were taking.
I think
it's a really tricky one.
Yeah, it would be very strange not to vote against it, I would have thought, yeah. Howard?
Look, what is this question about? I think we're sort of getting a bit mixed up. Is it about what socialist delegates would do if and when they are elected to Parliament in terms of reforms? Or is it what the party does now about reforms, the party's attitude towards reforms now? I thought the question was the latter, about what the reforms is now.
Well, the way it's written, Howard, the preamble says that each question tends to follow on to the next. So there's a kind of logical linear flow. And we've been talking about representation in Parliament in local elections. So I took it to mean what would an elected delegate do? But I mean, you're free to interpret it in any way you want, really.
I think that is a very... Again, another very improbable question to be asked by Jeremy Paxman or whoever. But you know, if it means the second thing, what's the party's attitude to reforms now, when it's a long way away from having any delegates in Parliament? I think what you said a few minutes ago was a bit misleading, Pat. We don't, you know, the party's policy isn't to support reforms that, you know, may benefit the working class in one way or the other, an extra day's holiday here or there, whatever. It depends what you mean by support. The party's policy is that we welcome such reforms. We're not against such reforms. We don't support them in the sense that we campaign for them. We don't campaign for them. That's the important thing. We may support them. We may say good, yeah, better that than nothing. But, you know... If we say we support them, it gives people the impression that we're joining with other people to campaign for them. We're not doing that. We've never done that. And we shouldn't do that.
Okay, all right. That's a useful clarification of the word support, I think. If it's an elected delegate, as I read it, support to me meant would that delegate vote for something or vote against something or simply abstain all the time? That's how I read it anyway. Okay. We've spent quite a lot of time on this one question again. I think we would have run out of time on Jeremy Paxman by now several times over. So, Paul, you're still a delegate central branch, I see.
Okay, you still am. Yeah, I'm sorry about that. So I'm trying to adjust that. So, first of all, I need to apologise because I've got one or two wee things going on at the bottom, many crises going on in the background that I've been having to deal with. I've missed one or two chunks of this tonight. Right, so you want to just move on to another question, or should I just say briefly that from the stream that I'm getting for that could be, well, we don't support any reforms, we just don't object to them all, you know. But I'm happy to move on to another question, and if you help me with it, I'll give it a try.
Okay. Well, Mike's in the queue. Mike, do you want to say something before I move on? Mike Foster?
Oh, hello. Just quickly on Howard's point. I took the question to mean, sort of both interpretations. I suppose we should be prepared to reply to it coming from either angle, as if they're sitting MPs or if it's just what.
We lost you there, Mike.
Hello.
Oh, you're back. Yeah. You're back again. Yeah.
All right. Yeah. Sorry about that. I think taking the question from the point of view of what a socialist MP would support, I suppose if you had a situation where you had a number of socialist MPs who were sort of trying to push to dismantling aspects of the state, once it reached that point, that's what delegate MPs would be able to do, to sort of do the technical and administrative dismantling of the state. That might involve supporting some reforms as a side effect. Because say you're dismantling legislation about property ownership, land ownership, issues like, responsibilities for health and safety, still within a sort of capitalist standpoint, you might have to tweak other legislation to temporarily cover changes to the state apparatus as a short term point until you've ironed everything out when it comes to legislation and the law. So I think we might have to pay attention to sort of the mechanics of how different aspects of the state impact on each other, and that might involve tweaking some laws before you can finally abolish them.
Okay, that's quite a curious interpretation of a process there that I hadn't thought of. Paula?
I was just going to say, brilliant answer, Mike. I love it. The idea, I really like that position. Where we're in the situation where we've got a majority, or almost a majority in Parliament, and what we're having to do is join in the legislative process to demolish the state. And in that situation, yes, we would be making reforms, in inverted commas. So, yeah, I'm 100% behind you there, Mike.
Okay. I wouldn't really call that a reform. I think that's a bit of a special case. I just kind of assumed that, we would declare the state abolished and and capitalism abolished. Anyway, okay. How's about moving on? Oh, no, wait a minute, Steve.
Well, the idea that the socialist revolution is going to sit and take apart 5 million words of bourgeois legislation is just absolute nonsense. We won't be doing that. once we've got a socialist majority, that's it. The end of the game.
That's kind of what I thought, yeah.
Yeah, well, okay.
Sorry, I interrupted. All right, so do we want to move on? Next one. When the Socialist Party, we're on number 9 now, when the Socialist Party takes state control, won't you create a dictatorship of the proletariat? Oh, and Brian's straight in there.
Bloody right I was.
Nick. Oh, sorry, Nick. Was Nick first? Sorry, missed you, Nick.
Okay, that's all right. I've taken more share up than anyone else. But my response would be, that's an excellent question. We certainly wouldn't be taking control of the state. I mean, that would create a very dictatorship that you're actually talking about. Our goal is the dissolution of the state. Thanks for asking the question.
Okay. Right, Brian, sorry, I stopped you there. Brian?
Yes, logically and historically, once we reach such a position, Socialist Party wouldn't even exist. It has fulfilled its function historically. It has served itself as a vehicle for the working class to use and achieved a legitimate and through the democratic process, political power for the working class. So therefore, it's up to the working class to turn around and decide for themselves what sort of arrangement they need in order to satisfy human needs.
Ratio, Paul Edwards.
Just ask me the question again, will you please, Jeremy?
Okay, then. When the Socialist Party takes state control, won't you create a dictatorship of the proletariat? Now, come on.
No. For a start, the Socialist Party will not be taking control of anything because the control will be in the hands of the people and the community, both far and wide. There will be no state within socialism. It will be the absolute democratic right of everyone to have their share of what's available and also have their share of decision-making. Next question.
Okay. Hang on. Steve's got in first.
Yeah, just to reiterate, Brian's answer is absolutely brilliant. It's something that we need to stress, that the Socialist Party isn't there to gain power. It's there to propagate the ideas of the socialist society. And what people have been saying on previous answers, we need to echo that and keep it in front of the working class and ourselves that anybody that represents the Socialist Party is a delegate and they have no power, personal power whatsoever. So they would have no personal power, and neither would the Socialist Party. Well, once we've achieved that socialist majority, we finish our task. Finish.
Okay, Jane and Tony, did you want to come in there?
Okay, so you've got your majority in Parliament. I'm not grasping how this. So you get a majority in Parliament and just suddenly magically, the whole thing dissolves and there's no more state and everybody just gets on with it. But, and from the sound of it, you're talking about a 51% majority. There's no suggestion of that. So you've got your majority. You're not making legislation. You're just saying, okay, well, it's all over, guys. The state's dissolved now. You can all go home and get on with it. For me as a non-SPDer, it doesn't sound very credible. There's a sort of gap. There seems to be a sort of point of, Does that make sense? I don't know. It makes sense to me.
Yeah. Okay. Note of scepticism there. This is why we want to be good at these questions, so that we convey what we mean exactly and with precision. We can come back to that in a sec. Mike Brown, you've got a thing.
Yeah. From what I heard, you said you just got a majority in Parliament. I'd assume that's Great Britain. What about the rest of the fucking world? You need to coordinate once you've got a majority with the rest of the world. Why are you not saying that? Why are you concentrating on fucking Great Britain?
Because it's in the question, Mike. I'm just reading the question.
You would have to say the world thing. I don't think anybody said that yet, apart from me.
True. Nobody's mentioned that this is straight out of the Leninist playbook. I wonder if it's, that ought to be put in. Anyway, there was a question that Tony asked before. Freddie, next.
Freddie, yeah, just taking up the point there that Mike was making, and again, very similar as the point I'm about to make, is that we don't see socialism just arising or a gathering of socialist consciousness just happening here in Britain. We see it happening simultaneously throughout the world. And I think by the time we get to this stage of where socialist delegates will be voted into the respective sort of parliaments or whatever they may be called at the time, that things will have changed quite substantially by that time. So, you know, the rise and the ideas of socialism will be spreading throughout the world, as they have been doing for the last few years, and it's on that basis. So, yeah, I take the point that Jane and Tony are making there, but I would certainly see the case, as I say, arising on a global basis, so therefore not just concentrating on what's happening in Britain.
Okay. Just as nobody else is in the queue at the minute, the idea that the word majority could imply that, we'd have a revolution based on 51% of the voting, but that's just not really feasible, is it? I mean, because you know, that's pretty much split down the middle. By the time you're able to get 50% of people who are willing to vote for socialism, the other 50% would be made up of all nearlies and very nearlies and some don't knows and a few opposition. So by that time, we would imagine that the pace would have picked up to the point where the change in people's minds was accelerating. So from 51% to 70% might only take a week or 2 weeks, and to 80% maybe another few days. You know, we would imagine that the pace of change would be very fast at that point. So that would be my take on that. We've got Brian. Yeah, sorry. Jane and Tony, can you just mute your mic because we're getting some feedback off you?
Sorry.
Clark,
I did.
Thank you.
I did.
Okay, all right, so moving on to the next one. Maybe got time for maybe one or two more questions. This is an easier one, I suspect. Does the Socialist Party always support the actions of trade unions? Does the Socialist Party always support the actions of trade unions? Who wants to take a bite at that? Brian again?
Not always. Sometimes you do, sometimes you don't. Depends on what action is taken. If it's democratic action, we usually support it. And by that I mean that deciding on what action the actual trade union memberships should take. You know, if it's a strike, I'd vote in to go out on strike. But also, just as importantly, vote in to come off strike. And not allowing the union leadership to take it out of the hands of the membership.
Okie dokie. Paula?
We would always support trade union members who are striking or agitating for better terms and conditions and better wages and better living conditions. But we would oppose trade unions who were striking because they were wanting to, I don't know, do something detrimental to other sections of the working class, like, for example, I don't know, stopping women going to work or, you know, stopping migrant labour working in their workplace, that kind of thing.
Okay, anyone got anything else to say on that? Mike Foster.
Yeah, I think I'd also point out that a lot of trade unions fund the Labour Party. So being a union member and not ticking the box to, avoid, a proportion of your dues going off to the Labour Party. I think obviously we wouldn't support unions to the extent that they support the Labour Party. So I think that's one aspect where we wouldn't. And if we're in a trade union, we should avoid our dues going off to the Labour Party because that's not what we're about. So yeah, I think I'd emphasise that the links between trade unions and the Labour Party, and that's an area of disagreement with some of the things I do.
Okay. Oh, Nick.
Can I just suggest... Oh, sorry, Nick. Let Nick go.
No, yeah, come on.
After you. Thanks, Nick. I was just going to suggest that it's not... I've had enough. Would you ask... I mean, I suggest that you ask the meeting whether they'd like to have a continuation this next week, and if we do some preparation on the topics that we've not covered yet. Because I think we could have done better than what we've got for now. Yeah, but anyway, that's my suggestion.
Okay. Yeah. Well, I'll come back to that. Let's just Nick's. Nick wants to talk, and then Richard.
Echoing the previous speaker, I think was it Mike?
Yeah,
I think there are a lot of people that haven't made a contribution. Is there any way that we could encourage more people to speak? I just feel as though, you know, a few people are speaking rather a lot and others are remaining quiet. So I don't know how, Paddy, you could open it up to other inputs.
Okay. On that, it's quite normal for some people just to want to listen. You get that, actual physical meetings too. Not everyone wants to speak. You know, some people are just quite happy to listen. So, you know, just as long as everybody realizes they're very welcome to speak or contribute or say anything they want, if they want, just put a thing in the queue. Richard.
I just found this really rather interesting, and it occurs to me that a lot of these questions could actually be made the subject of a talk or a question and answer session in future meetings. You know, just one at a time, to be quite honest with you. Somebody to sort of explore the party's views and maybe the way that the party's views have changed and the reasons for it, and then to have an open discussion about these issues. Because obviously there's been quite a lot of disagreement and uncertainty about a lot of these issues. So that's something that I would like to see. We certainly continue to do this on the same basis, you know, just going through them. But I think a lot of them we could well do with spending more time on. Like Tony's question, you know, I mean, we have... Vance needs to be kind of teased out and explored.
Yeah, I tend to agree with that, Richard. I think trying to think of ideas for FAQ sessions and looking at the speakers test, I think I've sort of hit the mother load, actually. So, yeah, just racing through them all like this, we're not doing them justice at all, are we? That's certainly true. And as you say, there's definitely not a fair amount of disagreement on a few of them. So that has been quite interesting. All right, Paul Edwards.
Yeah, no, I was just going to add, first of all, it's a terrific suggestion, and I'm inclined to agree with Steve in terms of taking it that little bit further. I think it'd be quite good, and I think back to it was a bit, maybe a couple of 3 years ago, and maybe even 4 years ago now, the party ran an excellent weekend event down at head office. There were about half a dozen of us attended. And there was one of these kind of public speaking experts were hired by the party. Although I think he was either a party member or a party sympathiser. I can't remember his exact name now. But he's done quite a lot of this kind of stuff. So it was taking the form of a schooling weekend to build confidence in this kind of atmosphere of an interview and maybe quite robust interviews and how best to deal in hand with it. And handle it, and I personally took some pretty good stuff away from it. I think most of those attendees did. I know Rob Cox was there, Carla was there, and one or two others whose names escaped me. But the recorded event, you know, not only audio but video recorded as well, and then we can look back on it and we can sort of try and pick apart, you know, each other's strengths and weaknesses. Now I think it would be quite helpful to. Yes, it's good to give everybody a shot at answering, and there's no reason why that shouldn't continue. But I think it'd also be quite helpful for as you were taking the role of Jeremy Paxman or whoever it happens to be tonight, the interviewer, to come back and challenge some of those answers again as well to give the the interviewee an opportunity to respond as well. It's just a thought, just a suggestion. I think it could work really well. But well done anyway. It's been a good session again. Cheers.
Okay. So I'm thinking we're just about, it's probably about time to wrap it up for tonight. Mike Brown, you've got something to say?
Yeah. How many questions have we got so far?
We've only got to 10. And
this one, 36.
36.
Yeah, I think we should continue this format because it's quite an interesting one. And then go back and revisit all the questions, what Richard Fales just said earlier. And then pick out really good ones to do. But I think we should go through the whole test first.
Okay, I think, yeah, why not do both? That's a good idea. All right. What we'll do then is
There's some very contentious ones coming up, isn't there?
Oh, yeah, yeah. Okay, what we'll do then is we'll schedule another one of these special FAQs on the speaker test. Not necessarily next week, Steve, because we've got stuff booked in already, but fairly soon. It'll be possibly next month. But we'll do another one. Why don't we say that everybody has a look at the speaker's test and looks at, because we got to question 10, so that's easy to remember. We did the first 10. And if everybody has a look at questions 11 to 20, kind of like homework, if you want to, and have a think about how you'd answer it, so that when we have the next session, we've done a little bit of preparation. But the other thing we can also do is we can highlight any questions that people don't agree on, and we can do a special FAQ just on that. So, for example, as was mentioned, the one that Tony was asking about, you know, that deserves a bit more of in-depth treatment, and there's a few of them that that do, don't they? So, yeah, that's does that sound like a good idea? I'm asking. I'm going to say that. Let's go with that, shall we?
Yeah, why not?
Yeah, we'll schedule another FAQ. So keep your eye out. It'll be a Wednesday evening, probably in December. Or yeah, we'll have a look. I'll maybe shift something else around. So let's say, and we'll do one next month on questions 11 to 20 in the new speaker test. Yeah.
Oh, Kevin's in the queue.
Oh, Kevin, did you want to say something?
Well, hi there. Can you hear me?
Yeah.
Is there a sort of formal party constitution document that sort of woven through it that these questions are sort of answered?
No, I don't think so.
Okay, that's fine. I just wondered.
Just to remind everybody where the speaker test document is. It's in the useful links text channel, so you can just go in there and click on it and download it and have your own personal copy. So for next time, I'll schedule it in questions 11 to 20, and let's see if we can rattle through those and identify ones that we might want to make do a special session on. How's that?
Thank you, Chair.
Okay, Howard?
Yeah. Just a reminder.
Can I just say, sorry, in response to Kevin, that answers to a lot of these questions can be found on the party's website under FAQs. There's an FAQ link. A lot of these questions are dealt with in more detail there.
The only problem with them, Howard, is that they're long-winded.
And we don't do that at all, do we?
You know, I mean, the purpose of the speaker's test is to give brisk responses. Not so much replies, but responses to the question.
Well, we've had mixed success tonight, haven't we?
I think Kevin is looking for information.
Yeah, that's right. I think Kevin was saying, is there one place where you'll find all this? But so I said, no, there isn't. But this stuff is on the website somewhere. Okay. All right. Well, good session, everybody. So keep an eye out for special FAQ part 2.